The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. This week, I want to take up the rising and spreading student protest that we are seeing all over the United States and indeed in Europe over the Israel's war in Gaza. These protests have taken over media attention and also have become a lightning rod in national politics with very divisively so on the Democratic Party side, with leading figures like Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi denouncing them. Indeed, the former House Speaker suggesting that some of the protesters had been trained by Vladimir Putin. But also, on the Democratic Party side, the rising cohort of Democratic Socialists in Congress are showing open support and meeting the protesters at Columbia University. To talk about all this, I'm very happy to have Joseph Howley, who's a professor of classics at Columbia University and who has been in the thick of things. First of all, thank you for being on the program. And secondly, can you just give listeners sense of what's happening? We're recording on Friday morning, and just what's the state of play right now?
Yeah, thanks so much, G. Thanks for having me on. It's been a wild week. We have had the police on campus about a week ago, right? So we had our president and our senior leadership in front of Congress last Wednesday. That's the day the first encampment went up. I think we all thought that that was pretty catastrophic for the university. Within 24 hours, before senior leadership had even come back to New York, they had called the police to dismantle the encampment. And while the police were still dumping out the protesters' coffee on one lawn, more students seized another lawn and set up a new encampment, which has been there ever since. So we had a kind of rough weekend. The university's the university calling the police and then the students sort of immediately overcoming the police action really made the campus kind of a flashpoint. We had protesters coming from all over the city, sympathy protests outside the gates, counter protests outside the gates, and energy was just really, really high. And I think that, it's been a good case study in one of the many reasons why you don't call the police on college students. Everyone is way more upset. And so over the weekend, there were a couple of incidents of like real hostility towards Jewish students or Israeli students. The solidarity protests outside the campus gates have sometimes been pretty aggressive or pretty extreme. And that's been really, really damaging in terms of the way that I would say bad faith actors in politics and the press have sort of amplified a few incidents that were not coming out of the protest encampment and sort of tried to make them emblematic of the protest encampment. So, we had the president coming out and condemning the protesters for this. And we had the Speaker of the House on campus the other day calling all the students, terrorists and supporters of terrorists. And I think we're all pretty sick of having our campus and our students kind of like misrepresented in the outside world, especially by people who really have no interest in like the well-being of anyone here. Or, I would say in the case of the kind of like MAGA Trump movement, people who don't really have any interest in universities as an institution. I think we really feel that we are bearing the brunt of an attack, an effort, from the kind of hegemonic Zionist right to suppress criticism of Israel, and then from their sort of friends in the American domestic right to just interfere with higher education and culture of free education and free inquiry, rather. So, we had a kind of scary night. I think Tuesday night we thought the cops were coming around midnight. We had faculty observers, faculty de-escalators who've been on campus all week, but everyone turned out Tuesday night. We thought the police were coming. And actually, one of the most upsetting things that's happened is Tuesday night at the negotiating table, the university threatened the students that they would let the governor send in the National Guard, which the university is now denying. But I'm quite confident that it happened. You know, I'm not sure what's worse, threatening college students, peaceful college students with military force, or lying about it, because it was immediately revealed that this was just like a false threat, that obviously the university can't do that. And that was a real escalation and provocation. I think it illustrated for us this week that the greatest threat to stability and the greatest threat of escalation here comes from the university as it's feeling squeezed by these outside political forces. But, you know, we got an extension on a deadline to early this morning. That deadline's been extended. The negotiations are ongoing. In my view, the students have a strong position and reasonable demands. And this is really just about how long it's going to take for the university to sort of recognize that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm very grateful for all the detail and analysis you provided. One thing is, I mean, like, you know, like, as a professor of classics, you know, you're aware of history, and it does seem like one of the lessons of history should be that if you have these sort of student protests, you do not escalate. And I would think, especially at Columbia University, which is, you know, famously the site in 1968 of, you know, one of the major escalations with the university president, Grayson Kirk, calling in the cops after protests and really tearing the university apart, and basically ending his own presidency by that decision, and creating like lasting wounds at the university, which went on for many years thereafter. So it is very curious that, you know, like we have this historical record of, you know, escalation is wrong. One could even mention more recently, in the 1980s at Yale University, the president, Giamatti, again called in the cops to protesters who were setting up protests for against South African apartheid and the university's complicity in that. I mean, that also, tore the university apart and ended Giamatti's tenure in that position. So can you say something about, given, you know, some pretty obvious lessons of history, why are the universities, so many universities, opting to escalate?
I mean, that's a great question. I don't know what they teach you when you become a university president these days, but as a faculty member here, I mean, it's almost a joke here, the way that the first story you get taught when you start teaching at Columbia is the story of 68. That's this watershed moment. Everyone here has an opinion on 68. You know, people who were students, there are faculty here who were students in 68. There are, you know, trustees who were around in 68. People have lots of different opinions, but everyone agrees it was transformative. People think it was hugely damaging. The university kind of never really recovered in terms of fundraising. And people say that's why our endowment is still low compared to our peers. I don't know if this is true. But yeah, I cannot imagine walking around the administrative center of this university and not thinking of that in a climate like this. But also, frankly, in this country, in the last decade, we have just gone through a massive social justice movement focused on the dangers of police and police violence. You know, so the NYPD, I appreciate very little about NYPD. I appreciated how clear they were about the lack of threat and danger on this campus. But I think we all know that, you know, all it would have taken is one car backfiring or something off campus, and things could have gotten really bad really quickly. Mm-hmm. So both recent memory and recent history more remote 20th century history, if I can say that, would seem to indicate against this. And, you know, I guess we have to reckon with the fact that this kind of repression we're seeing all across the country for these protests in particular has to be about what they're protesting. It just, there's no way that it's only about how they're protesting. And, you know, I think we have to recognize that there is a kind of, there's maybe a suite or a set of causes in this country for which protest just brings immediate and overwhelming force, whether that's from the state or from institutions. And it seems like the cause of Palestinian liberation has become one of them. And that's, I think it's a pretty unfortunate place to find ourselves.
Yeah, no, I think that, yeah, the sort of Palestinian exemption is maybe the best explanation. But also maybe something that you mentioned before, which is that the universities are being squeezed from these outside forces, that, you know, which include the sort of political figures of both parties that have been intervening, but also the donor class. Like, do you think, like, you know, that's a big factor here?
I was in a room the other day where some senior university leaders were saying, actually, the donors aren't really putting that much pressure on us. That's not, most of the pressure is coming from the government, from Title VI. I'm not really sure how much I trust that right now. There is a, I mean, look, the like the Israeli press has reported on the Israeli government's efforts to influence and connect with the American donor and trustee class. And this was being reported on back in the fall. This is like a program of the Ministry of Diaspora Affairs. I mentioned this, by the way, I'll just say I mentioned this reporting in a speech I gave at a student rally, and I was I had complaints filed against me for peddling anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, for talking about like Israeli government policy that's been reported in the Israeli press. So that's kind of the climate that we're in. It is, I really, I mean, I do think that we're, look, the story is that we have an anti-Semitism problem on campus. Anti-Semitism is always a problem. I feel pretty confident we don't say, I'm confident in saying we don't have like a widespread systemic anti-Semitism problem. But I think some people have a problem with criticism of Israel on our campus. Some people have a problem with, unfettered intellectual inquiry on our campus, right? So you've got the folks who want to suppress criticism of Israel. And then you've got this really aggressive political movement in this country, both to kind of interfere with higher education and to just score points by seeming to interfere with higher education. And these groups have found common cause. It's convenient for the folks who want to be able to rewrite curricula through special interest groups that there is currently a cause that is so easily painted as dangerous or threatening or prejudiced. I think if the climate activists were as militant right now, militant may be the wrong word, if the climate activists were as kind of organized and vocal and out there, you might see similar efforts. But this is the thing. I mean, this is the thing that we see from this campus, right? Is like, we've been watching our friends and colleagues at state universities and colleges around the country as, legislatures and state houses, like in North Carolina and Florida, they throw out the boards, they take tenure out of the university, they rewrite curricula, they order centers to be closed, people to be fired. That's a lot of that has been focused about gender and race, right? And there's an underlying principle there, which is that like universities are sites of free inquiry. They're where young people come together and learn. They can be hotbeds of like political education and consciousness and organizing. All of those things are kind of anathema to a certain, component of the American right. And so at the Ivy Leagues now, this is the wedge. This is the opening to come in and, demonstrate, establish that political special interest groups can have power over curricula. And if they can get away with it here on Israel-Palestine, then they'll be back next year for vaccines or climate or race or gender.
Well, no, I think that makes a lot of sense, and but it also maybe points to a weird political asymmetry that maybe is worth calling attention to, because I mean it's absolutely the case that the right is very organized on educational issues, both at like the level of like public school education and at higher education, and that they're constantly looking for these wedge issues to kind of impose and popularize their ideas. And like it's striking that a lot of the discourse of people that are involved with this on the right wing side is focused not just on alleged anti-Semitism, but also they immediately jump to DEI and affirmative action. So we can kind of see where the right is, and that makes sense. But one does not see comparable counter-mobilization on the liberal democratic side. And this is, you know, despite the fact that campuses, you know, especially in the sort of swing states, are the margin of victory for the Democratic Party. And that, you know, like one would think that there would be some awareness that like defending educational system from political intrusion would be like a political cause that resonates with like a core constituency of the Democratic Party. And okay, I mean, to be fair, you know, one sees that maybe a little bit more in the lower education side. There has been a lot of pushback on like school boards and on, you know, attempts at censorship on the public school level. But it, I think it's very noticeable that on the level of higher education, there's no counter-mobilization or political organizing, you know, among mainstream liberals who one would think would see this as like, a core demographic, a core a part of their coalition.
You know, I'm part of a bunch of different faculty groups here, and we, you know, back in November, those of us who really care about Israel-Palestine and could see immediately that Israel-Palestine suppression and crackdown on academic freedom were hand in glove. We all got organized pretty quickly in November. And you know, since then, I've been trying to figure out, well, how do we address exactly what you're talking about? Like, where are the liberals? Where are the liberals on this? Where are my good liberal colleagues? We can talk about the Palestine exception, I will say, like, you know, I got together with some colleagues. We formed a group of about two dozen Jewish faculty members. We sent a letter to the president about a week before the congressional hearings, which I can send that to you. And we tried to lay out this case, and our goal was specifically, how do we cut through the kind of BS and confusion around criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism? How do we make a place for people to stand and just help people recognize that this is just like the basic stuff of liberalism? You know, this is just like a basic tenet of a free and democratic society, is you have to be able to have like discussions and inquiry and debate and even protests on university campuses. So I think it's really felt this year in particular, like I've been living in kind of an alternate reality from so many people, but particularly, you know, just waiting for a more kind of center left response to this, and in some ways still waiting. I mean, you know, where's the president? You know, I was just with some students, and we met with a member of Congress who was visiting campus this morning. He wanted to meet with some Jewish students, and they were talking about their experiences, and I asked them, you know, look, so much of the political interference and messaging from other politicians has only deepened divisions on this campus. What can this member of Congress do to help that? And the student immediately said, like, talk to your party leadership, like talk to Hakeem Jeffries. Like the students also want mainstream, you know, democratic politicians to be not taking a side like on Israel-Palestine, but just kind of speaking up for like basic sanity and reality and facts on the ground. I mean, I have a lot of issues with the presidency and the policies of Joe Biden, but I think I've never been quite as shocked as I was this weekend when, like, very quickly, a kind of like right-wing misrepresentation hype machine of what was going on campus led directly to a White House statement. It's just, yeah, I wish I could explain it to you. I think you're the political analyst. I'm just a classics professor. But what you've identified is also what we identify as the kind of main desideratum right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are ways to maybe explain this historically or generationally. Like, you know, Joe Biden belongs to a generation of liberals that were, sure, you know, particularly coming out of 67, attached to Israel, see that as, you know, part of their politics. And it could be like in terms of social environment. I mean, like, I don't think I'd be very surprised if Joe Biden has any anti-Zionist Jews in his social circle. Let's put it that way. If you don't aren't aware that position exists, right, that leads to a certain blindness in how you perceive things. But I mean, it is a very curious thing because, you know, like, you know, this is an election year, you know, like, all the polling seems to indicate, you know, that the Democratic Party base, and this is like well outside of college students, and it's well outside of even young people. Like there's, you know, been a turn against within the regular Democratic Party voters, you know, against what Israel is doing. So to what degree the leadership of the party is insulated from that opinion shift? I mean, I think that's a real question. And I think that that, you know, both explains Biden's behavior, larger policy behavior and his behavior towards Colombia. But it also, you know, I think it really threatens, you know, his prospects of reelection.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we're all worried about, because like, if this is what it's like, if this is what the assault on higher ed from Congress is like under a Democratic administration, what is it going to be like when Trump is back in power? You know what? And if you know, I have to say, in my, you know, relatively inexpert opinion, I think DOE has been really bad on this. But if this is where DOE and Congress are on, you know, going after universities now, I think we are being stress tested right now for the next Republican administration. I think it's going to be really ugly. And I mean, look, I'd be the first to admit that sort of in a big picture cultural sense, I think that as academics, we have just kind of in the time span of my career, not been doing a good job of explaining to the rest of society why what we do matters. And when an education at a place like Columbia costs as much as it does, and, you know, when like the job market is so uncertain, and, you know, and I say this as now an elder millennial, you know, when like it's not entirely clear that like a college degree is going to, you know, put you on the path to a job that gets you owning a house or being able to afford having a family or whatever. We feel I see in my students that they're coming in and they're thinking, okay, I need a degree that's going to get me a good job. They're not coming in thinking, here's what I want to study, here's what I want to learn about. And so I think as a profession, we are paying the price now for not having better invested in explaining what we do and making the case for what we do to the outside world. That having been said, I think we're in a position now where it's kind of make or break. I mean, looking at what happened in that congressional hearing, it was really shocking. I mean, it was really shocking to see, like, the words academic freedom were never uttered once. Terrible things were said about our institution and my colleagues, and no one responded to them, you know, in any way except to acquiesce and say, yes, you're absolutely right. They're all terrible. I'll fire them immediately. If our president and the chairs of our board of trustees don't believe in us enough to like defend us and advocate for what we do in front of Congress, I think a lot of us are wondering, like, who's gonna stand up for us? And I mean, you've seen unprecedented mobilization of Columbia faculty on campus this week. So on Monday, there was a mass protest on the steps of our administrative building. Must have been something like 300 professors out there in full academic regalia, protesting simply the over-disciplining of our students, the arresting of our students, and the selling out of academic freedoms in front of Congress. And that protest was not organized by any existing faculty advocacy group. It wasn't organized by Faculty for Palestine. It wasn't organized by the AAUP chapter. So that's how kind of organically I think the faculty are coming together now. And I guess I'm just sort of hoping that it's kind of not too little too late for higher ed.
Yeah, no. I mean, I do think that, you know, the starkness of the escalation is going to like shift opinion. It's going to shift opinion precisely on that sort of liberal middle ground of people who might not be very invested in Israel-Palestine, might prefer not to talk about it. But because it becomes an issue of academic freedom, then it becomes something much larger, but also like not just academic freedom, but like, you know, these images of students being beaten up. There's a widely circulated image of, you know, at Emory University of a professor of economics, Caroline Folan, being manhandled by cops. I mean, like, I don't think I would be very surprised if, you know, that does not, like, you know, waken certain people up and, like, you know, makes them aware of the stakes. And that goes again back to the escalation question, because, like, even though it's, like, very terrifying, like, I'm actually, like, not sure what exactly is the end game, or the, you know, how the pro-Israel side thinks they can win this, right? Like, as they keep escalating, the protests are spreading, right? Like, you had the tents in Colombia, now they're, like, being set up at, you know, MIT and Harvard, and, you know, you're seeing protests. You know, the school term is coming to an end, but it'll start up again in the fall. And I don't see, like, you know, this level of state repression working. I don't see, like, you know, public opinion is not being converted to, you know, thinking that, like, you know, well, Israel is doing good in Gaza. I just don't see, you know, like, what even from their point of view, what they can hope to achieve, except making a lot of people miserable and maybe destroying a lot of major institutions.
Yeah, I mean, I share your bafflement. And this is like, I've been doing a lot of press this week, and everyone asks me, like, what's the end game? And I'm like, from the other side's perspective, I've got no idea. I mean, you could, okay, if you think about this in terms of the kind of, like, the sort of, you know, general kind of Israel lobby, like ADL, like, I guess I would just say, and I say this having been raised kind of like a non-Zionist Jew who is, like, now identifies as pretty solidly anti-Zionist, because I, like, fundamentally loathe nationalism, especially ethno-nationalism. Like, look, in Jewish communities, we are familiar with the injunction that you simply must never criticize Israel, certainly not in public. And that might work, you know, you know, in family settings or community settings, but it actually doesn't work as policy. Like, it's not practical as policy. You can't make it illegal to criticize a certain government in this country, and you can't make it illegal to criticize a certain government on a college campus. Okay, so, like,
well, I would also add, I don't think it's even working on a family level, at least.
Yeah, right, totally.
From what I hear from Jewish
absolutely.
Friends.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
no, continue. I hear that from my students, too, the student activists who are, you know, they're estranged from family members or have difficulty with family members. Absolutely. And, you know, then we might, another way of thinking about this would be, is all this policy actually an attempt to kind of translate the illiberalism of the Israeli regime into the American context, right? Yeah. Like, you know, in Israel back in the fall, they were putting school teachers in jail for criticizing the war in Gaza. And, like, you know, have we somehow kind of reversed the flow of colonial power, and suddenly we are being asked to acquiesce to a kind of political colonization of our culture around this? That's simply not going to fly. We don't have the apparatus for it here. It's so incompatible with our norms and values. And then, you know, but then what I start thinking about is, like, in practical terms, like in the work that I and my colleagues are doing, I think we need to understand this as a failure of the kind of university leadership, board of trustees class in this country. And this is, like, I say this not being an expert on this, not knowing, not, you know, not working in that line myself, but it's been astonishing here to see at every single juncture the wrong step taken, and to see every other university repeating the mistakes that are being made here. And this must partly be the result of sort of professionalizing trends in the profession of university leadership and cultural or political trends in the world of boards of trustees. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but in practical terms, looking at my campus, just the last 10, 20 years, the one thing I can see has happened is that faculty have been pushed out of the room. So now more than ever, universities are really run by people who are, like, not faculty members, not promoted from out of the faculty, seem to have only really distant engagement with education or educational mission. And, you know, so that's certainly the solution we're asking for here. You know, people have been asking me, oh, do you want your president to resign? Should you have a vote of no confidence? Should you have a vote of censure? I'm not interested in handing the Chris Rufos of the world, you know, another notch on their belt in terms of being able to get Ivy League women presidents fired. And so I'm very reluctant to see our president lose her job in a situation where, like, you know, Elise Stefanik's going to take credit for it. I think there's a lot of people who have made decisions running this university that have gotten us into a very bad place. And I'd like to see maybe some different leadership up there, just personally speaking. But I think that what many of us in the faculty are now asking for is a reconfiguration of power in university leadership. Like, you know, after 68, after they brought the cops on campus and beat a bunch of students and bloody, and, you know, interesting bit of trivia, they even beat the campus rabbi bloody because he was protecting the student protesters, dragged him off. After 68, we set up the Senate, we set up these rules. You know, section 444F of the university statute says the university president has to consult with the executive committee of the Senate before cops are allowed on campus. And this last week when the cops came, the president wrote to the executive committee and said, we're bringing the cops in. We have now consulted with you. And the executive committee said, we do not approve of bringing the cops in. And the university said, we have fulfilled our obligations under section 444F of the university statutes. Well, you know, I've heard that for decades, the norm of no cops on campus without Senate approval was strong enough that, you know, it wouldn't happen again, except if it were absolutely necessary. But what we've just learned actually is that university leadership thinks they don't have to get the input of faculty. They just need to tell faculty. Well, I think what we've seen then is like, that's not good enough, right? Like faculty who are actually involved in the work of education and research and learning, I think we just have to consider the possibility that we actually have a different stake in the well-being of the institution and everyone at the institution than leaders who are more responsive to concerns of PR or donors or political pressure or whatever. And, you know, I'll also say, like, the faculty, why do I think faculty have that better perspective? In part because we have tenure. I could be here for the rest of my career, you know. And university leadership comes and goes, and deans get promoted to be provost somewhere else, get to be promoted to be president somewhere else, right? But, you know, as the academic job market contracts, I may be here for the rest of my career because there may never be another job I can apply for in my field at another university somewhere where I would want to live, right? And there's many members of the university senate who have been here for their whole careers, and that gives you a long durée perspective and a long-term investment in the institution. And I think we're just being faced with the possibility here that however we have professionalized and selected for our leadership class, that's not actually delivering what we need to like preserve the institutions and their values as institutions of higher learning and education and learning, as opposed to just like, you know, investment funds with real estate portfolios who happen to teach some classes.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, it points to maybe a larger discussion one could have at another point. But I mean, it is, you know, like, not to be too jargony, but the sort of neoliberal university where sort of, you know, the whole idea of faculty self-governance has, you know, thrown overboard for being these kind of, you know, financial institutions. And they are behaving in a certain corporate way that is very familiar. So it seems like what all this is pointing towards is that, you know, like several larger fights that include the Israel-Palestine battle, but then also are about the universities making a political case for themselves and making a case for, you know, to those politicians that rely on, you know, the votes of students on that behalf, and then also the faculty reconsidering its role within the university and pushing back against some of these changes that go back, like, you know, several decades in terms of the rise of the administrative state.
Yeah, you know, I try not to be one of those professors who complains about administrators per se, because like I know and like and work with a lot of administrators, and also like there are important jobs that need to get done at universities by people who are good at them, and not every job works well with having a faculty member rotated into it for 3 to 5 years. I'll just say that. But the other part of this, I mean, you talked about the neoliberal university. One of the most unsettling kind of watchwords that we've heard in recent years, certainly, you know, we heard it a lot with the pandemic and the kind of push to get back on campus before it was safe. And then also on this campus with a recent really nasty graduate strike we had, where the graduate students were unionizing and striking for a fair contract. this watchword we've heard all the time is student experience. We have to deliver a good student experience. And this idea is another component of the neoliberal university, is the idea that that students are primarily customers, and that as customers, they're entitled to certain things, chiefly an experience that has like certain parameters, certain dimensions, and that imperative, you know, overrides other commitments, other values we have. So that, you know, that I think is another component of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Although, I mean, the paradox is like there, you know, on behalf of this ideal of student experience, you're like actually, you know, send the cops and the National Guard to beat up students. So right. Which doesn't seem to be, which is maybe a type of experience, but maybe not one that is a good selling point for the university.
I mean, we like to say that you know, the students are getting in this last week an incredible education in all sorts of things that weren't necessarily on the syllabus. This is a point that scales. You know, people say you got to keep the Jewish students safe. Well, you just arrested a bunch of Jewish students protesting on the lawn. Okay, so to protect the feelings of some Jewish students, you're going to throw some other Jewish students in jail. Mm-hmm. You've got to keep all students safe. Okay, well, so we're going to bring armed NYPD onto campus and drag students off. And now, you know, we've gone hybrid so that students who are uncomfortable here don't have to come onto campus. And I think people probably first immediately think of like, you know, Zionist students, Jewish students who feel uncomfortable with this political expression around. But equally, you know, I think a lot of our students who are, you know, students of color, queer students, women who've had bad experiences with the police might not want to be on campus if they know cops are around. Mm-hmm. To get personal, but like I have a kid who really likes coming to work with me. And in the past week, past 2 weeks, she's basically become like paralyzingly afraid of coming onto campus because we all have to pass through checkpoints now to get in and out of campus. The main walk of campus is a part of 116th Street. It's normally open to the public. But now all of a sudden, any entrance into campus, you have to swipe through a checkpoint. And, you know, I knew intellectually, you know, about like life in the West Bank, that's a kind of a traumatizing and dehumanizing experience. It has been so upsetting to see just in 2 weeks, my own child, you know, be like traumatized by having to pass through checkpoints. And that's an education, you know, mm-hmm. That's a kind of harm. I think one thing we're seeing is none of these justifications or explanations for these kinds of repressive measures, none of them hold up, right? Improving or preserving the student experience, that doesn't hold up, right? Like protecting Jewish students, that doesn't hold up. Making the campus safe, that doesn't hold up. And so we're sort of rifling through a deck of index cards to try to ex post facto explain what it is that we're trying to do. But I have to tell you, Jeet, like because I was active early in the fall on this issue as a faculty member, I right away started getting brought into like disciplinary meetings. People would say, look, I'm in trouble. Can you come to my disciplinary hearing? So a lot of faculty have been going to these hearings with students, and the repression, especially at Barnard College against these student protesters, has been obscene and outrageous. But back in November, I got asked to accompany a staff member to a disciplinary hearing where their dean was it wasn't a disciplinary hearing. The dean was threatening them with disciplinary action if they didn't do something. And what they were being threatened for was that they had posters on their door that said things like, let Gaza live and like end the genocide. And they were in trouble for this. And they asked, well, why do I have to take these posters down? And the dean said, it is the position of the college that this is not an acceptable form of political speech. And I was immediately like, can you explain that at all? And within days, the college had rolled out new rules that no one can have political posters of any kind in the workplace. And then we got to no students can put anything on their dorm doors. You know, everyone wants to go to the liberal arts college where you can't decorate your dorm door, right? Yeah, but like, and so immediately they were like, oh, we have to actually come up with something that sounds like a reasonable rule to justify what we're doing. But I feel very lucky to have been there in the moment before they figured out how to put the mask on. Like right there in November, everyone was just saying what they were actually doing, which is like, we want to suppress speech about Israel-Palestine. And in this shuffle to build these larger ex post facto notionally kind of fair or reasonable frameworks to justify that, all they've done is just heightened the stakes for like damage to the fabric of the institution.
Yeah, yeah. No, no. I mean, it's absolutely the case, as you mentioned earlier, like, you know, in some ways, like, you know, to defend Israel from critical speech, the only solution that they can fall back on is to turn the United States and its campuses into another Israel, which I don't think, like, you know, from their own point of view, is going to, like, you know, make people love Israel anymore, because I don't think that there's a big constituency in the United States that wants, at least among the people who go to college, that wants America to become Israel. I actually don't even think there's a big constituency of that on the right, to be honest. It's a fascinating case study. And I guess it's, in some ways, it's an honor for people who study history to also watch history being made, as we have, like, over the last few months, and especially the last week. On that note, I want to thank Joseph Howley for speaking like very eloquently and with real depth about what's happening both at Columbia and I think is happening at college campuses all over the United States.
Great. Thank you so much, Cheet. And if I can just put in a plug, we have student journalists on this campus working very hard to document what's going on here. The Columbia Spectator, WKCR, we have a student blog called Blog, B-W-O-G. So I'm really grateful to you for taking an interest in what's going on here. And I would just encourage anyone who's trying to follow what's going on here to tune into what the student journalists have been doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks for that. And I'll actually put links to that on the show notes. And in fact, I think a lot of the reporting that's coming from the people that are actually there, the students, and the few journalists that actually go on the ground, wildly contradicts a lot of the political speech that we're seeing. So, I think that's a good note to end on.
Thank you so much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.